Our speaker today is one of the best known names in South Australia. I say names because he's so much in the news that we hear it almost every day. But many of us, apart from that solid support base along the Murray in the electorate of Hammond, and we have the Mayor of Murray Bridge with us today, don't know the man at all. So today will be fascinating for that. We do know he's the man who delivered the Rand government, and in return we know he's demanded such things as inquiries into the judicial system and paedophiles in teaching positions. But most importantly, he has demanded reform of the very way we govern ourselves. And if this can do away with the sterility of parties and the tyranny of factions within those parties, then we'll all be deep in his debt. So just what are his ideas on constitutional and parliamentary reform? What changes do we have to make for Parliament to be relevant and responsive? Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome our speaker, the speaker, Peter Lewis.
Our President Don Riddell, my parliamentary colleagues, the Honourable Mick Atkinson, the Honourable Jane Lomax-Smith and Mr. Joe Scalzi, Mr. Clem McIntyre, Chair of the Panel of Experts for the Constitutional Convention, distinguished guests, folks of the media, friends all, let me tell you, you can never tell which direction the train went by looking at the tracks. Some would say, and I'll come back to that later, that I'm blessed or cursed with the self-imposed duty of now getting it, the Constitutional Convention and change, to happen. After only being able to talk about it and to dream about it for more than 20 years, the 20-odd years that I've been in Parliament and even before that, it was, after all, a substantial part of the reason why I went to Parliament, or sought to in the first place. It is about to come to fruition. The vision is to enable the formation of a government for our state, which is open, accountable, responsive, and relevant to the community. Today is the 21st century, yet the institutions of government that we have at present, their structures, and the relationship between the Parliament and the bureaucracy are from the 19th century, with adaptations that have been made by the political parties for their convenience along the way. They no longer work in the public interest. It's time for change to the South Australian Constitution, and there is no more appropriate or fairer way or more sensible way to introduce that change than to consult the very people in whose name it's to be invoked. Though not all of the more than 1 million adults living and enrolled in South Australia can make that change under the present structure. So we'll need to have an abstraction of that sufficiently large enough in number to enable us to be sure that it's incapable of being manipulated by any interest groups, yet small enough to be manageable in the way in which it deliberates on the issues that it considers need attention. Folks often ask me, what is a constitution? A constitution is the set of rules or principles that govern a country or a state. It's the contract between the citizens and their government, states what the government's obligations are and how that is fixed. South Australia has a written Constitution Act of 1934, which sets out the basic framework of government. Other acts supplement it at present. For example, there is the Supreme Court Act, which creates the Supreme Court, among other things. There are also a series of unwritten rules or conventions relating to the conduct of Parliament as well as to government itself. I'm very pleased that my Compact for Good Government was signed by both the Liberal Party and the Labor Party. It delivers to us the historic opportunity as ordinary South Australians to shape our own future. The Constitutional Convention will be held on April the 11th next year. It'll probably take the whole of that weekend, at least in the first instance. In recent weeks, a Parliamentary Steering Committee, nominated by the Liberals and Labor, has convened by me as chair to authorise the process of the convention. Cabinet has determined the structure and creation of the committee. That's the steering committee. And members are drawn from both houses, from both government and opposition. They are the Honourable Ron Roberts, President of the Legislative Council, the Honourable Dean Brown, the Honourable Angus Redford, the Honourable Robert Lawson, the Honourable Gail Gogo, Mr John Rau, the Honourable Michael Atkinson as Attorney General, and me. The Parliamentary Steering Committee has appointed a panel of experts who include specialists in constitutional law, in society, in history, and economics, prepare a discussion paper for the convention. They'll also be able to write issues papers according to their own inclinations about those subjects, which will be placed on the web and circulated through that and any other medium that anyone wishes to obtain them. That discussion paper will be a summary of the points for and against. It'll discuss the areas of possible constitutional and parliamentary reform identified in the compact. There are others, of course. They will come after. Let me emphasise, it will put out for public comment for everyone in our community to have a say. And I stress, the result will be discussed at the Constitutional Convention. There won't just be the one weekend. There will be other matters that need attention above and beyond what it's possible for that first group to deal with. The members of the panel of experts have recently been appointed, and they are Dr. Clement McIntyre, who's here with us today, has been elected by them, by his peers, as the chair, Associate Professor Peter Howell, Dr. Geoffrey Partington, Professor Judith Sloan, Dr. Jenny Stock, and the Honourable Len King, and the Honourable Trevor Griffin, and Professor Geoffrey Walker. Five questions distilled by the committee from the Compact for Good Government are to be considered by the panel of experts in that discussion paper, and those questions distilled from the compact are: should South Australia have a system of initiative and referendum, commonly known as CIR, and if so, in what form, and how should it operate? What is the optimum number of MPs? That is, in each of the Houses of Parliament, necessary for responsible government and representative democracy within the Westminster system, which is currently operating, or upon which we rely in broad framework here in South Australia. The third, what should be the role and function of each of the Houses of Parliament? And the fourth, what measures should be adopted to improve the accountability, to improve the transparency, and the functioning of government? And the final question is divided into two parts. First, what should be the role of political parties in the Legislative Council, if any, and what should be the method of election to the Legislative Council? What should be the electoral system, including the fairness test, and the method of election to the House of Assembly? If we now revisit those questions, we'll be able to see how the Constitutional Convention will fill in its time. They are substantial. The Convention procedure has been designed to give consideration to how our Parliament and government will run our state for our families and our futures collectively. In South Australia, we enjoy a number of freedoms. They are freedoms of assembly, freedoms of speech, freedom of religion, and freedom to associate or not to associate with people whom we choose, always subject to the rights of others. South Australia has often been at the forefront of social justice and civil rights, making us an innovative and groundbreaking society, indeed state. Let me give you some examples of that. South Australia was the first Australian state to allow women the right to vote, and at the same time the first place in the world to allow women the right to stand for Parliament in 1894. In 1897, South Australia's Catherine Helen Spence stood for election to the Constitutional Convention for the Federation, becoming Australia's and the world's first female political candidate. In 1858, South Australia introduced the Torrens title system for the determination of who owned what piece of land, and that was created by Robert Torrens, at that time a Member of Parliament, and it revolutionised the method of recording and registering freehold title of land. The system was adopted in the rest of Australia fairly shortly afterwards, and now in many countries around the world being referred to as the Torrens title system, both in the East and in the West, Vietnam being the most recent. South Australia is also a place that is good at scientific innovation. South Australians invented the first document copying process. We were at the forefront of developing antibiotics and invented the stump jump plough and trickle irrigation. For such a small place, we've had many outstanding achievements. What we need to do is have confidence as a community, put party agendas to one side, and get on with maximising our chances for success as a democratic society in the future, in a sustainable framework of government that accepts that it's for the people's interest, the public interest, not the parties or the government of the day. Since the mid-19th century, the South Australian Parliament has been responsive to the community and its ever-changing needs. But we need to ensure that the foresight of the early settlers is maintained and that we continue the progressive insight into how the state, the parliament and the government should look to meet the challenges of the 21st century and beyond. Let's get on with doing what our forebears have been so good at doing. Ever since Colonel William Light and his innovative choice of the site of Adelaide and the planning of it as the capital of this state, we have been prepared to show leadership in social change. Wakefield kicked it off, if you'll recall. Then came Light, followed by Torrens, Catherine Helen Spence, a fellow called Kingston along the way, and his son too, and a few others, and it continues to this day, doesn't it? Why should we be afraid? The Constitutional Convention will give us all a chance to make a difference, to have a say and to design our future, and to design the decision-making and law-making processes. Some people have claimed that this is quite a revolutionary thing to do. Indeed it is. Remember, in 1215, King John saved his neck by sealing the Magna Carta. A form of democracy had thus begun. Just as in 1649, a mere 400-odd years later, when the English lopped off Charles I's head and in 1698, they introduced the Bill of Rights, then came habeas corpus, and so on. In the middle of the last century, we saw Tom Playford here devise the concept of the housing trust. That provided low-cost housing, and it enabled this state's economy to get going in a way that wouldn't otherwise have been possible after the devastation of the world's economies by war. He then nationalised electricity. Evolution and reform have always been a part of our history. We've never been violent here in South Australia. We've always moved in tune with the times and avoided violence. So it is with the South Australian Constitutional Convention, where we will bring about reform and change for the better. But we will do this without violence and upheaval of the kind we saw in the 1640s, which resulted in Charlie's blood being spilt. I want to lay down a challenge to the accepted wisdom of the phrase, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. It is true that we've progressed with the current system relying on the Constitution. It has served us reasonably well. However, the current system doesn't work the way it must, if people are to increase their confidence and embrace their rightful role as citizens of the 21st century. It works better than in many places in the world, but it can work even better than that. The time's come to ensure we continue to have a democratic and representative system of government in South Australia into the future, more so than it is at present. Just contemplate for one moment, if you will, by chance you happen to know what the Constitution says about the matter, the horrible thought that were it so unfortunate that Nick Xenophon could not return to Parliament, how would we decide his replacement? And why is that such a problem? I can tell you that in the past the South Australian House of Assembly has had as many as 54 members and as few as 36. Where can the fear be if we find today, through our constitutional convention, the need to change the number again? Not with the people of South Australia, no, but with the political parties themselves, I suggest. It's 32 years since we last changed the number. It's time to consider that again. Many people will claim that constitutional reform has never worked in this country. That simply is not true. The very structure of the Australian government is the result of the greatest act of political evolution, probably in the history of humanity. I use the word evolution deliberately. It wasn't accompanied by violence, not revolution. And the constitutional reform that I refer to is this country's history, now its federation. Just because the first rocket blew up on the launch pad, that didn't stop any of the people trying to make it fly, dreaming about getting to the moon and eventually doing so. So it is with constitutional reform. Let's give it a go. This is not even rocket science, but social science. That part of it called democratic design making from a well-informed base. The original South Australian Constitution was drafted in 1856 and the current Constitution Act passed in 1934. The Constitution was drafted to suit the needs of the community at that time. Look at how times have changed since 1934. We now have equal pay for women, the internet, and daily flights to other capital cities. The listeners to crystal radio sets of the 1930s could never have envisaged the world in which we now live. The world of TV, and now that's gone digital. Satellites, and the world of space travel. And so, it's incumbent upon us, the people of South Australia, to work toward setting up a constitutional convention to help frame our parliament and government for the 21st century. My job, as I saw it, after the last election, given the unique opportunity about which I'd dreamed for so long that presented itself, was to make it possible for this to happen. So let's get it happening together. For example, direct democracy, that is CIR, for those who know it by a different name, in a form that's effective, will be a good way for people to be able to express their wishes collectively in the majority. It will be a constructive outcome for the Constitutional Convention. My concept of CIR is a three-stage process, such as Parliament, evolved over the centuries for the passage of good ideas into new law. As you know, a bill is read three times to ensure that every member of Parliament knows that the bill is under debate and knows that it's their opportunity to express a view about the matter and, in doing so, try and convince their colleagues that their view is based on more information or better science, where it differs from the views of others and that they in turn should follow that view. At least that was what Parliament, when it was established, was meant to achieve. That doesn't happen today, because the real debates take place behind locked doors, in the party rooms, or more particularly, in the factional meetings, before the party meetings, And that's where vested interest takes over from public interest. South Australia has always been a world leader in new ideas and in many industries. For example, the wine industry, fisheries and aquaculture, the defence industry, and now IT. We've always had a first-class, indeed a world-class, can-do attitude to things. Have we got attitude? We have already shown we can be groundbreaking and work together to make South Australia a state of which we can all be proud. Well, let me say in conclusion, the South Australian Constitutional Convention will truly engage the South Australian people to consider what ought to be the future for their society, and it will engage the Parliament and the panel of experts into making a difference, into making history, and to making the future happen. Don't be an observer. Be a participant. You'll be on the train. You won't be trying to work out which way the train went by looking at the rails. Let's do it together. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much indeed. Now, question from the media, and in the known way, would you please state your organisation as well as your name? And even though I would not dare to tell the press how to go about their business, could we have at least a couple of questions about the Constitutional Convention before we get into other matters?
You mean there's something else going on?
There's always something else going on, Mr.
Hi, Peter. It's Catherine Hopley from the Advertiser. First of all, you would have heard about Rory McEwen and his decision to join the Labor government today.
Rory who?
Rory McEwen.
Oh, the Honourable.
The Honourable Rory McEwen. First of all, what's your response to that, and does that make your position and your power base redundant?
I'm sure he'll be an Honourable Minister like all other ministers are Honourable Ministers, and I'm sure that it'll enhance the government and it'll make no difference to my role in Parliament or the Constitutional Convention, whatever.
Do you think this is going to lessen your power with the government, your persuasion?
Sorry?
Do you think this is going to lessen your power or diminish your power with the government or your persuasive factor?
No, that's immutable. That's already a contract. And fortunately for everybody here and everybody who's not here but living in South Australia, as I said, it was signed by both the Liberal Party and the Labor Party. In spite of what some may want to tell you, the original copies are in safekeeping, and anybody wants to see it, they're welcome to come and see it. Frankly, I think the events of today underline the need for a constitutional convention.
Just in terms of the compact with Labor, do you think Rory's decision is going to undermine your compact? Do you think?
Look, Labor's... I know 6 months ago Rory said, well, it was more than 6 months, it was back early this year, that it wouldn't last for 6 months. But we all know a week's a long time in politics, even a day.
Given your experience in Hammond after you decided to deliver power to Labor, what do you think the reaction of Rory McEwen's electorate is going to be to his decision to go with Labor? It's a fairly traditionally conservative electorate.
Ask them.
Just in terms of the Constitutional Convention, considering you've been talking about perhaps the Constitutional Convention is considering a cut in the number of MPs. Now, if this is going to get up, it's going to need the support of Parliament. Do you think that's going to happen? Is that likely?
Catherine, why would Parliament not do the will of the people if, after deliberating on the issue, they made recommendations which meant that there would be more or less members of Parliament? It would be a bold Parliament that said they'd got it wrong.
If I may ask, how many more questions do you have?
Because I was wondering, you know, if I was Speaker, you wouldn't have had the call.
Supplementary question, please. Just in terms of, there's been a bit of media about the Speaker's wig and your new wig. Just wondering how much that actually cost and where was it produced?
Sorry?
How much did the Speaker's wig cost and where was it produced?
There's only one place in the world that makes wigs, and if you don't know where that is, it's not difficult to find out. And as for what it's cost, I've not got that figure in my head, and it's not something that's relevant to today anyway. I haven't asked you whether you bought a new pair of shoes yesterday, and I won't tell you whether I'm wearing clean knickers.
Just again, you don't think it's a taxpayer's right to know how much that wig cost and where
it hasn't blown the budget, and it's not something of consequence.
What's the budget for a wig?
No idea.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Wendy Glamacek from the ABC. Catherine's covered a lot of ground that obviously a lot of journos want to know the answer.
Closer to the microphone, please.
Okay. Do you feel that, or what assurance have you been given from the Labor government about your position and your grip over the Constitutional Convention? Have you had any conversation with Premier or any other front benches about your role and whether that's being watered down?
There's absolutely no doubt about the Constitution Convention. It will happen on April the 11th next year. All of its participants will have the benefit of the issues papers that are prepared, and more particularly the discussion paper that comes out of that from the expert panel. And I'm quite sure that their deliberation on those questions will be fruitful, useful for all of us. And we all ought to embrace it and join in with it. Nothing that's happened any time since February the 13th has changed that fact. It was always going to happen from that day forward.
So has the Premier given you an assurance that you'll continue to play a leading role and not...
I don't need the Premier's assurance. I've got his signature.
Okay. And secondly, what does Rory McEwen's ascension to the front bench mean? You said that it might require constitutional reform earlier.
Sorry?
Will Rory McEwen's decision to be the 14th Minister in a Labor government require constitutional reform?
Oh, you mean change to the Constitution? Yes. But that change presently can occur. It's not an entrenched provision, so it can occur by a simple act of Parliament to increase the number of Cabinet Ministers to 14. Now, what the Labor government has decided in that respect, I don't know. That's not my province.
Just finally, what does Rory McEwen's decision to join the front bench mean for Conservative politics in South Australia?
Oh, I guess it'll be interesting today, effective tomorrow, and whatever the consequence, that'll be a matter for history to decide. We'll leave that to posterity.
Thank you.
Peter Miles came from the Advertiser. Just on the Constitutional Convention, you seem to have a committee where the members are selected, all of them, except for you, by the two major parties. Then you have an expert panel selected by the people selected by the major parties, all but one. It sounds a bit like a model where you'd have journalists deciding on alcohol prohibition. How did you let the major parties hijack the independence of your process?
Between now and April the 11th, there'll be ample opportunity for everyone in South Australia who's got an opinion to express that opinion. I'll certainly be personally inviting other people to write issues papers. Whether or not they're taken into consideration by the expert panel is a matter for them to decide if they arrive in time. Equally, other people around the state, arising from the town and country meetings and the other meetings that I'm happy to go and address anywhere in South Australia, the more the better, will be able to express opinions through whatever group discussion process they wish and send their opinions to the Constitutional Convention office. What we need to do is not bother about the territory, but be enthusiastic about the process and willing to put our own views forward as individuals who believe we have some understanding of what will make it work better.
Thea Williams from The Australian. You may feel as though you've already answered this, but I'll ask it again anyway. You said earlier on you thought today's events underlined the need for constitutional change. What did you mean by that?
I didn't catch the question, I'm sorry. Could you step a little bit closer to the microphone, dear?
You said earlier on you thought the events of today underlined the need for constitutional change.
The events of the day. Oh, yes.
Today.
Yes, yes. I mean, who says that we should have 13 ministers or 10 ministers, or that the magic number is 15 or 12 or 14 or whatever it is? How did we arrive at that figure? I think the people ought to have a say in that. They've never had a say to date. It's, after all, their cost. It's their government. It doesn't belong to the party in power. It ought to be included in the constitution in a way which ensures that before it can be changed, the people have to be consulted through referendum. That would mean any change would require the mass, at least in the majority, to be convinced of the desirability of that change before it occurred.
So we ought to have had a referendum to decide whether Rory McEwen could join the ministry.
No, I didn't say that, Thea. What I said was the number of people in the ministry ought to be determined by referendum. Let me tell you, Rory will make an outstanding minister. Rory has outstanding abilities. I meant what I said when he'll be an honourable minister.
Mr. Lewis, Laurel Irving from Channel 10. It sounded like your comments earlier, you didn't think that Rory's decision was entirely in line with being an independent MP.
Well, it can't be, because in Cabinet there has to be solidarity unless you're Robert Tickner.
So has Rory McEwen sold out?
Sorry?
Has Rory McEwen sold out?
Ask him that.
Do you believe
that? I don't know what his bank balance shows. And I'm not going to go there.
But, Mr. Lewis, do you believe that he has lost his independence and has lost what he
He's lost his independence. He has to. Any member of Cabinet has to agree to act in solidarity with the Cabinet decision, regardless of how they may have thought about it or spoken about it in the meeting at which it was decided. You can't have a government that isn't disciplined in that way. You will never be sure of what it is that's going to be done, and neither will society. That's why we've been more successful as a society, because we do elect the people who make the rules and administer those rules, called laws, and the policies, and we know that through that election process we will get a government of a number of people who act as one.
The government is saying today that you support and welcome Rory McEwen's move into the ministry. Are they being a bit optimistic?
I couldn't catch that, I'm sorry.
The government is saying that you support Rory McEwen's move into the ministry. Is that true?
Rory McEwen's move into the ministry, I congratulate him.
Is it a good thing for South Australian politics?
It'll mean that Rory can apply his considerable intellect to those portfolios that he's got: trade, local government and regional development. Amongst the people in the Parliament, Rory would have as much insight as anyone into those collective responsibilities that he now assumes under whatever framework it is that he's appointed. I have confidence in his ability to do that job. He knows that he is now part of Cabinet. He must act as part of the government. He no longer acts as an independent. He cannot. He must resign should he decide to vote against the government on any matter whatsoever. Before he does so, he must resign from Cabinet. That's the convention.
On the Constitutional Convention, when you made your deal with Labor, you had very high hopes and some fairly significant reform in mind.
Yes.
Given that the major parties are playing a fairly large role in this convention, how do you judge your success? Because it looks like you may not get all that you wanted when you first made the deal.
I'm not a selfish man. I grew up with 9 other siblings. I learned to eat fast. I'm doing my best, and I'm happy to allow posterity to judge whether that is worthy of applause or criticism as time passes.
Fair to say, though, you'll be fairly disappointed if you get to the end and it's just tinkered around the edges a little bit?
Get to the end of its Tinkerbell?
No. If you get to the end of the
There's no fairy dust in any of this. I'm fair dinkum about the lot of it. The people of South Australia will make the recommendations to the Parliament, and I think, let me say it again, it will be a bold government, and indeed a bold Parliament, that will reject the recommendations drafted into legislation through that process of a deliberative poll with a cart on the end of it that enables the deliberative poll's recommendations to be taken to Parliamentary Council should they recommend legislative change, have those changes drafted and put into the hands of the Parliament. It would be a bold Parliament indeed that would reject that, and I would be very critical of all of my colleagues were they to do so without some amazing oversight having been exercised by the Constitutional Convention. And remember, there is a panel of experts. They will not only write the discussion paper, but they will also be available at the Constitutional Convention to discuss, to answer questions that arise from any member at the Convention about any issue whatsoever. Altogether, I can't think of a better way of changing society into a form which will be more gratifying, more engaging, and more responsive to the needs of the majority from time to time than through this process.
John Murch, Radio Adelaide. Mr. Lewis, I've got two questions, if you don't mind indulging me in them. The first one is, how much is this Constitutional Convention, another one for Australia, going to be costing the taxpayers of South Australia?
Less than the alternative of doing nothing. Why would Robert de Crespigny be saying what we now need to do is to recover our confidence in ourselves and take up the challenge? Well, we can do that economically, in the development of a more prosperous society, if and only if we believe that the processes of government are the kinds of processes that we think are relevant. So, if it costs $2 million in total, out of a budget of $8 billion, you can do the sums, but it's not a lot. And it does inspire confidence, and I'll bet that you wouldn't buy that measure of improved confidence by all the spin doctors and PR firms of the country for the same sum. You wouldn't get the same measure of participation and involvement from the community at large that you will otherwise be able to get through this process. And after all, it's being spent on taxpayers who participate in the process. If there were a revolution to rise up against the Constitutional Convention, then sure, I guess it would stop, but that's just not happened. Why is it that people still come to me and say, "Good on you, Pete, about time we did something like that"? And that doesn't matter where I meet them, whether it's in the front bar at the sheep sale or at the show, wherever that may be.
Mr. Lewis, the second question is regarding, of course on this issue you're very articulate, but some other issues you've been speaking about recently you may not have come across as articulate. Are you going to now be a little bit more quieter on issues of pedophilia, for example, in the public arena, so that the Constitutional Convention can actually go ahead with a spokesperson like yourself who can be completely articulate?
Why would you want me to be? Why would anyone? But I can only say so much. My focus is upon the Constitutional Convention. I've alerted the government to the risk to which it's exposed, and that's the end of the matter in a public sense for me.
Mr. Lewis, my name is Steve Gawler. I'm the chief executive of a local council, the City of Holdfast Bay. So I guess I work in the third tier of government. I think I'm right in saying that when you outlined the questions which are going to create the framework for the convention, I didn't hear a question about the ongoing need for the upper house. Given everyone's interest these days in both the cost of government and the effectiveness of government, what are your views on that, please?
The upper house in its present form, in my opinion, is probably far more expensive than the benefits it delivers. But an upper house is an imperative part of any democracy. What needs to happen is for the upper house to be made representative of people, not political parties. I drew attention to that dilemma as it now stands. I'll go on further and say it ought to be comprised of 6 regional seats, perhaps created by combining 2 House of Representatives seats, so that we, through the members elected for 2 terms from those seats, 1 at each election, we would have representatives of regional South Australia with a responsibility for that region to ensure that a political party's view about how to spend money in the lower house doesn't adversely impact on the interests of their region or other regions in the process of making the decisions. Most of our problems in this state, in terms of our failure to take advantage to the extent that we could have and should have of the talents and infrastructure and opportunities that are there for economic development in the regions, arise because of pork barrelling that started 30-odd years ago when regional interests were denied and political parties that wanted to win office had the pork barrel on the metropolitan fringe to do so. That's where the money went, the discretionary expenditure in our state budgets, and the country at large, the regions, was not treated as fairly as it should have been in the interests of the state at large, because the wealth that was generated there did not continue to grow in the way that it could have and should have. Secondly, in the upper house, there needs to be people elected at large, and I think there probably needs to be 9. One of whom, of those elected at large for just the 1 term, one of those 9 ought to be elected by exhaustive ballot of all of the members after they're sworn in as its president, and the other 8 by the same process could chair each of the parliamentary committees. Because they're elected at large, they would be able to see the big picture of the state and know that that was their only chance of being re-elected again if they did, and do the job chairing that committee of either reviewing what government proposes to do with taxpayers' money, such as in the Public Works Committee, or review what government has done with the money after the event. We call that committee the Economic and Finance Committee, or used to be the Public Accounts Committee, and to review policies which we think to be important in environment and resource development, in social development, and so on. Those committees ought not to be in the House of Government, because then you only have government policy dominating the committee, and you, what's more, have members of that committee wanting to improve, enhance their prospects of being appointed to the ministry. And one thing they will never do in the circumstances is point out where the minister or the ministry collectively has made a mistake. And if they do that, it means probably they belong to the opposition, in which case the committee has been bastardised in its role. Put them in the upper house, take all the ministers out of there, and leave the upper house to do the job of reviewing government legislation as well as government action, including local government, and we'll have a better, more functional democracy as a consequence. Now, I'll let others take their views to the Constitutional Convention on those points and see what comes out of it.
Just a minute, Mr. Turpin. Are there any more questions from the media before I open up to the floor? Brad, could you ask? I'll just finish the media section first, if I could, Mr. Turpin.
Just a quick one. You've mentioned the people associated with the convention, all eminent people, and you've mentioned opportunity for ordinary people to have their say, be going out to public meetings, and I accept you're very passionate about it, but surely for a lot of people, the words constitutional convention are a cure for insomnia. There will be people more interested in paying their mortgages, raising their children, just getting on with their life. Is there a danger that this will be a change by the elite if these people aren't brought into the process?
No, I've got a lot more faith in my fellow citizens than you obviously have. And if they are given the opportunity to have a say, as they do in supporting their favourite sporting body, whether it's a football club or a netball club or lacrosse or whatever, they will have a say and they will have an opinion. And I respect that. I invite that. I encourage that. And especially enabling the process of... then the next phase, have that good idea turned into a draft of a change to the law and printed by the Electoral Commission and circulated. And if more than 5% of South Australians, for instance, were to sign that petition and that it was verified that they were all citizens by sampling and testing it in an appropriate way, then it ought to go to referendum and a debate ensue in the community on which no party can spend more than $10,000 to ensure that big corporate interests or fanatical groups can't buy a referendum outcome. If you have that process and a majority of people pass, give their assent to that change, then I propose it should go straight to the governor for proclamation, not to Parliament. It's called direct democracy. I can't see anything wrong with that at all. I've got a lot of faith in my fellow citizens. In other countries, they fight for what we've got. We take it for granted. It could be so much better. There's no reason why we shouldn't contemplate a change. And it's worth doing it once every so often. Perhaps we ought to do it every 10 years.
Questions from the board. Frederick Tobin. Mr. Lewis, South Australia has always been known as the state of dissent. And in 1995, the Advertiser featured four groups it labelled extreme right wing. And when Alexander Downer addressed one of those, he said, "Oh, I thought it was only a Christian group." And you'll be addressing a group, one of those listed in 95, next Friday week. What is your attitude towards dissent in this state?
Well, let it happen. What's wrong with dissent?
In other words, you're not going to do a downer next Friday week and say, "I didn't know that this is an alleged extreme right-wing group that you'll be addressing."
I don't know what it is you're speaking about, but I'm not afraid to talk with anyone or listen to them. If they're making sense, I'll listen.
Thank you very much. That's all I wanted to hear. Thank you very much.
Eva Lado from the Australian Craniofacial Foundation. In the Federal Parliament, MPs cannot hold dual citizenship. Should this be the same for South Australia? Will this be on the agenda for discussion?
You're asking my personal opinion. No, I don't think they should. However, the Parliament's determined that issue otherwise. I wouldn't have any problem with it, but it won't be in the first tranche of the Constitutional Convention. That's already agreed. There will be, through public consultation, the opportunity to determine if other matters ought to be discussed.
Good, thank you.
I think this is the last one, thank you.
Michael Patkin, retired non-journalist. Mr. Lewis, thank you for an inspiring outline of what you want the Constitutional Convention to achieve. For people like myself in this new millennium, one of the most powerful ways to make a contribution to this discussion is through the internet, and I presume there's going to be a website for
this. There is.
Yes. Can I please ask you to make sure that it's more usable than other similar websites? The General Generational Health Inquiry has a website, and the devil is in the detail, where it takes a long time to download each submission to read it, and where there isn't any sort of summary of what the contents of that are. And if you want people to be able to see what the discussion is going on, would you look at the usability of this website by people who don't have a broadband connection at home and whose eyesight is three times worse than the 20-year-old?
We have templates on the website. People can put their opinions on that template about the topic. And the Constitutional Convention Office will download and print that out. It'll be available to the panel of experts.
And what about the issues papers? Will they also be in this?
They will. They will.
Right.
Thank you.
No question about that.
There's one more question, I believe.
Thank you. Mr. Lewis, David Crocker from Wallman's Lawyers. I was interested in your views of having some judges elected.
Interested in my views in having some judges elected?
Yes.
Have I ever said that?
I have no idea. I was interested in your views. Right. Whether you think it's a good idea as part of the constitutional reform.
I think it would be a good idea if enough people wanted to debate it, to have it put on the agenda for discussion. Judges are elected in the United States. In our society, that's not been the case in the past. There are dangers. If you elect a judge, I mean, yeah, I think it's worth considering, worth debating, and that it ought to be done through a convention process which involves sufficient number of people, like the 300 I've referred to, that ought to be there, taken as jurors are from all walks of life, anybody from anywhere doing anything.
Thank you.
And allow them to deliberate upon that and come up with a recommendation about it. It ought not to be just left to someone like me, 40 or 50 of us or whatever, to decide alone those kinds of questions that are about what's called the grim norm in society. And if you don't know what that is, look at Chapter 5 in Selway.
Thank you very much indeed. I think, Rory McEwen, notwithstanding, you managed to get the subject back to the Constitutional Convention often enough. Thank you very much indeed. And would you take with you a magnum of St. Hugo Kunawara Cabernet Sauvignon from Orlando? And if you don't want it, I'll keep it. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed. Good night. Thank you.
Okay, before you start chatting, get out your raffle tickets and we'll see who's lucky today. I'd like to call up Susie Lamshed, Corporate Affairs Manager for Telstra. Will you make her welcome? Radio. Sue has given us from Telstra the audio line cordless phone with digital answering system and call display, and it is Green D72. Green D72. Who's the lucky person? Hey, up there. Come on up. And Walter, come on up. Walter Rogers from the Rock Lobster Cafe. Now, pop in there to Gurgis Street if you want some wonderful seafood. Blue D39 for the $50 voucher from Rock Lobster Cafe in Gurgis Street. Blue D39. Over here. Come on up. Walter, also you have for us the $50 voucher from Ragone's Press Club. Do you know the Press Club's coming to have lunch with you at Ragone's? The committee, we're going to come and have lunch with you. $50 voucher. Who's got it? Which one is it, Susie? This one here? Purple D42, and I think it's D Williams. Hey, over there. And for a carton of Southwark Premium, somebody's going to carry this back to the office. Carton of Southwark Premium.
Oh.
Oh. I think it's D69, isn't it? Yeah. Blue D69. This one's ripped in half, but it looks like it's 69. Anybody got blue D69? Over there. You've got a carton of Southwark Premium down here. And for a carton of Hahn Premium Light from SA Brewing. Oh, I can't read. Jim, somebody, Green D41. Is that Jim Matic? Our treasurer. Jim, you are the luckiest person. You're unbelievable. So you've got the carton of Hahn Premium Light. Thank you, Sue. Susie Lambshed from Telstra. Thank you. Finally, I'd just like to remind you, because we'd like to make this a really great luncheon on Friday, the 6th of December. I think this is going to be a great lunch with Alexander Downer, the Foreign Minister. There is so much for him to talk about. Tell all your friends. Get them all here for Friday, the 6th of December. Thank you very much, and thank you for your attendance today.